This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first full week of July, and as we tape on Thursday morning, the U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan is complete for all intents and purposes, according to Politico. About 600 U.S. troops remain in the country, largely to protect our embassy in Kabul. U.S. troops withdrew from Bagram Air Force Base in the dead of night without even telling the Afghan army we were leaving. And the Afghan government has been losing ground to Taliban fighters as it struggles to retain its grip on power in the country. Our now nearly complete military involvement in Afghanistan has run almost 20 years from the immediate aftermath of the September 11 attacks. And one key question is, what do we have to show for it? To talk about that, let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined on the left by Liz Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Josh.
And on the right, Ross Douthat, columnist at The New York Times. Hello, Ross.
Hello, Josh.
So, Liz, both Barack Obama and Donald Trump talked about wanting to end this war. It looks like Joe Biden, who is the one who is actually pretty much ending it.
Yeah, and good for him. I mean, long time in coming. Like you said, it's been about 20 years, most of my life. As long as I can remember, we've been in Afghanistan. It's time that we got out. It's amazing. It doesn't really take someone of tremendous moral courage because it was so obviously something that needed to have happened a long time ago. And so here we are.
Ross, as far as I could tell, the best argument for many years for staying in Afghanistan was basically that all of the alternatives were worse, that if we withdrew, the Taliban would come back to power, that it would provide a safe haven for terrorism. And we saw what happened with that in the 1990s. And that so we needed to stay essentially indefinitely in order to prevent that. And we had shrunk our footprint in the country to a point where we really could do that indefinitely, and we pretty much were doing it indefinitely, if we felt that that was necessary. And the question I was growing to have about this was basically, how is it possible that in 20 years, we were not able to arm and train the Afghan government so that it could do this defense mission itself? It seems like, you know, it shouldn't be necessary to do this sort of thing indefinitely, and yet here we are, we're withdrawing, and it seems like that is what's going to happen. This government, I do expect sooner or later, is just going to fall.
Yeah, that seems to be the general consensus. I mean, I think you're right that the what you have to see as in hindsight now as the sort of most disastrous period of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan from the U.S. perspective has not been the last 5 to 7 years where we have maintained a pretty light footprint there. It was, in hindsight, mostly the Obama era, where we attempted a sort of more sustained surge of forces and investment in the country. You know, this is now lost in the mists of time, but way back in the George W. Bush presidency, the Democratic Party had committed itself to the view that by invading Iraq, we had sort of lost Afghanistan, and that we, you know, it was more appropriate to spend money and commit troops to Afghanistan than to Iraq because of the connection to 9/11. And this in turn sort of fed into the Obama White House's strategy of pulling out of Iraq while investing more in Afghanistan. And that seems to have been a disaster that in turn sort of, I think, conditioned public perceptions of the war thereafter. That if you had maintained this kind of light footprint approach from 2007 on and just said, look, you know, this is sustainable. It's not costing many U.S. lives. It's not costing a ton of money. We're just trying to prevent safe havens from developing. Afghanistan might not have become what I think it did become, which is sort of a condensed symbol of forever war, that every president had a political incentive to claim to be the person who ended. And Biden has sort of seized what Trump, I think, for political reasons, should have seized and failed to because he couldn't get the military to do what he wanted because he was incompetent.
But so in your scenario there, we would still stay in Afghanistan and we would stay there indefinitely. Your view is not that that would have led to some sustainable outcome where we could leave eventually. It just would have led to an outcome where it was more politically sustainable to just keep doing this forever.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just talking about political sustainability. I think, you know, not to be a sort of, you know, true, you know, dark heart of human nature is, you know, not amenable to U.S. military supervision or something. But I don't think from what we've seen in Afghanistan over the last 20 to 40 years that there was a likely U.S.-led nation-building effort that was going to sort of create a, you know, yeah, a sort of sustainable government on any reasonable timeline. I think you're just, maybe you're sort of hoping that emerges in some organic way that the U.S. can't control if you're staying there. You're not sort of planning for how to make it emerge, because it, I think it's pretty clear that we don't have that capacity.
Liz, is the argument that we need to stay because leaving is worse, is that argument wrong? Are you concerned about the possibility that we will have a return to the 1990s status quo, where you have a rogue government in Afghanistan that forms as a safe haven for terrorist action around the world that will sooner or later end up drawing yet another round of military response?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's almost inevitable. At this point, I think that you can see it happening sort of in real time right now as the Taliban parades weapons they've seized from the Afghan army, sort of in celebration and in mocking the United States' efforts to train the Afghan army to resist the Taliban. And at the same time, I mean, there are so many governments around the world that are hostile to the United States and that are hostile to American interests. We talk about them on this program every week. We talk about North Korea. We talk about China. There are plenty of states out there that don't like what we're up to or would prefer that we did things differently. This rogue state or state-like actor, the Taliban, becomes just another one of many. And there's nothing that we can do about that. Even if there weren't a safe haven, there are tons of sort of stochastic lone wolf terrorists that operate under terrorist brands like ISIS, right, that inspire people to take up arms and conduct mass shootings or other terrorist acts sort of independently around the world on a dime. We respond to those incidents when they happen, and we set up preventative measures to try to keep people from undertaking those kinds of activities. And we use intelligence in the domestic zone to try to control those who are in our borders planning those kinds of events. But I just think, similar to Ross, that it's beyond our capacities to create a lasting government in a foreign country that we do not have any kind of legitimate control over that is friendly to our interests. That is something that we have not yet succeeded in doing.
A remarkable thing with this is how terrorism in general, and especially Islamic terrorism, has fallen off the map in terms of a political issue, and also I think an issue that is salient for the public. And you know, we've had this pandemic and the rise of an increasingly hostile China and a number of other things that have sort of overtaken this as a concern. But it's almost weird to me to look back on the politics of the aughts and how central this issue was in American politics, and how terrified people were that there would be more attacks, and the attacks that followed in Europe and elsewhere subsequent to September 11. This was a dominant political issue. Has this fallen off? Has it fallen off because we overrated the issue at the time? Has it fallen off because we've actually had a lot of success using the manners that Liz describes there to contain terrorism as a threat, and you know, almost as a criminal threat? Are we right about this now and wrong about it at the time, or is this something that's going to come back around the bend, Ross?
I mean, I assume it will come back in some form. I think we can say that we were wrong about the scope of the threat in the period of sort of existential panic that understandably followed 9/11, and the decisions we made in that period to essentially embark on multiple nation-building experiments in the Islamic world were bad decisions. I think that seeing Islamic terrorism as a serious danger and threat and possibly destabilizing force, though, was never crazy or wrong. And in fact, I think at this point, we now sort of underrate how much ISIS had an impact on Western politics in the 2015 to 2016 period, right? It's sort of in analyses of like, why did you get Brexit and where did Trump come from? The fact that you know, you had this self-styled Islamic caliphate inspiring terrorist attacks in the US and Europe in a period of sudden mass migration from the Middle East into Europe. Like, all of that has a lot of explanatory power that I think people have sort of forgotten, precisely because we crushed ISIS, right? Like, we crushed the Islamic State, we defeated it. And I don't know if Liz would endorse the system that we have set up. But I do think that sort of an approach that says, you know, where you have self-styled state entities that are deliberately stoking terrorism against the West, you should use military force to crush those entities. And the rest of the time, you should pursue a strategy of sort of counterintelligence and special forces-based management. That is the strategy that we have. So, you know, so if tomorrow the Taliban took over Afghanistan and then announced that they were welcoming Al-Qaeda back and would be sponsoring new terror attacks against the West under this strategy, you'd have to go after the Taliban again. But if the Taliban just retakes power and confines themselves to doing, frankly, terrible things within the borders of Afghanistan, you wouldn't intervene. I mean, it does seem like a strategy that is at the moment working from America's interests.
Well, I think another thing that you can't underrate the impact that Syria had on ISIS as well. So ISIS had heretofore been sort of sending out spores all over the place in hopes of spreading its caliphate across the Middle East. But the fighting in Syria, especially as it intensified, seemed to draw those men who had been coming even from the West to Iraq and then going back home after receiving some training, or even those who had been watching from the West and learning sort of methods online and then carrying out attacks in their home countries, it inspired them to go to Syria and spend their time there. And there was more than enough conflict there to take up their time. And so I think that sort of divided, if not, you know, soaked up quite a bit of the energy that was latent in ISIS. And then, you know, the West's response was also clearly pretty overwhelming. I think what's worth keeping in mind about ISIS is the worst terrorist attacks carried out by ISIS in the West did not really even require a great deal of sponsorship or planning. They're not Al-Qaeda. They're not going to spend a long time on laptops, getting guys trained to fly planes, et cetera, and carefully orchestrating a very, you know, precise and advanced technique like 9/11. All they're going to do is get some guns and ammo and go to a big event, right? So they are just using the techniques that all American mass shooters use every day. And those are just as effective in terms of terrorism, inspiring terror, and in terms of body count.
In practice, that seems like it should be true. But looking at the pattern of terror attacks, again, in the U.S. as well as Western Europe, it did seem like having an actual entity claiming to be a caliphate had some sort of a special impact, I feel like, on would-be terrorists' willingness to do, you know, for reasons allegedly of, you know, sort of religious zeal, what U.S. mass shooters do for you know, other reasons, right? It seemed to have some impact. Now, maybe those are people who, absent ISIS, would have committed mass shootings for empty nihilistic reasons. But it did seem like there was some connection between the fact of there is a caliphate set up in the Middle East and, you know, the Bataclan shootings, the Charlie Hebdo stuff, the stuff in the U.S.
No, absolutely. I mean, it does seem like there's a relationship, and it seemed to me like a brand. I mean, to put it in terms that the young people who were carrying out these attacks probably are very familiar with. They see it online. It's a thing. It's something that you can identify yourself with, congregate under. It has symbols. It has slogans. You attach yourself to it, but you do your own thing independently of any funding. Which is all just to say, yeah, it's concerning to imagine Afghanistan becoming what it was in the 1990s with respect to terrorism, but it's also the case that you sort of don't need safe havens and a huge amount of money to do the kind of things that terrorists are doing now.
And I suppose it's a hopeful sign that our military actions with regard to ISIS seem to have been successful also in disrupting the brand. which is not something that I think you would have known ex ante would necessarily be the case, but it seems to have worked, which is a good sign. I want to turn to a domestic political issue. In the U.S., we have a mayoral result in the largest city in the U.S., or at least we have a result in the Democratic primary, which is tantamount to being elected mayor of New York City. Next year, Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, a former NYPD captain who ran a crime-focused campaign, is very likely to be New York's next mayor. He narrowly beat Catherine Garcia, who was a former sanitation commissioner and had support from the New York Times and good government types. Maya Wiley, who was the favorite candidate of left-wing activists in the city, finished third in the race. Adams has a bombastic and colorful personality, and I look forward to the rest of the country getting to know Eric Adams, who I think is quite a fun character. He also says he's the new face of the Democratic Party. Liz, do you see national implications from this result?
Well, I certainly see prominent Democrats talking about it and taking it seriously. So it seems plausible to me that there will be an impact on an overall Democratic approach to electoral politics, especially in advance of the midterms. Yeah.
Ross, I've found it interesting that conservatives, in many cases, have wanted to latch on to Eric Adams. Eric Adams had the endorsement, among other things, of the conservative New York Post. And I feel like his conservatism has been really overstated in the national conversation about this race. I mean, people look at him and, you know, he's an ex-cop. And we have all of these fights over policing and police reform. And Adams was very dismissive of the idea of defund the police. But he also has a decades-long track record as a police reformer, including his time as a captain in the NYPD. And I look at this and I see a key part of what happened here is that Adams is someone who went in with credibility on both sides of these issues, saying we need policing. We have a surge in shootings in this city that we need to address and people need to be protected by the police. There are places where you need more police. But the police also need to treat people fairly and you need reforms of the NYPD so that the police protects the citizenry, doesn't abuse the citizenry. And this is not the defund the police messaging where you hear people basically say that the police can't be fixed or that the way that you have to fix policing is to shrink it. But it's also definitely not the Donald Trump messaging. And it's not the messaging that you see from Republicans where basically the idea is that the whole problem is that there's not enough respect for police and that we just need more and tougher policing and that that's the solution to the surge in shootings that we've been seeing not just in New York, but around the country.
So, Josh, I mean, you may recall that my rant from the last time I was on the show was about how we were paying too much attention to New York mayoral politics. So I feel that in good conscience, I can't actually do any analysis of this without violating my own rule. But I guess I'll try. I think you're right insofar as there is this race, like the Democratic primary in 2020 that Joe Biden, your candidate, won, demonstrates the gap between, where the American left is in its very online and also sort of foundations-based institutional form and where Democratic voters are, even in New York, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think Adams represents a kind of centrist to center-left view of policing that would have been immediately recognizable as such 5 years ago. And now, for reasons of, you know, mostly of shifts on the left, is coded as more conservative. And I think it sort of suggests, one, that, you know, as long as the Democratic Party can sort of find candidates in different ways like Adams and Biden, it can avoid some of the political problems that are created by having a left wing that is associated with, you know, police abolition and related causes. And it suggests that maybe there are limits to the opportunity that kind of, you know, frankly, unpopular left wing politics offers to Republicans. As long as you have these figures who can emerge to sort of embody a sort of a center left that pushes off against that left. How applicable, you know, how this translates into national politics, I think is, you know, a totally open question. And Adams, like Biden, is a pretty distinctive figure. What the Adams equivalent in, say, the Florida gubernatorial race, you know, or Ohio politics or Texas politics would be is, I think, an open question.
Well, I mean, I think it's a decades-long tradition that the mayor of New York should be a huge weirdo, and Eric Adams will continue in that story.
What are his views on ferrets. That's what we need.
I don't know, but I'm certain he has them. The funny thing, though, with this, and Liz Ross mentions that, you know, the things that are sort of coded as conservative from Adams probably wouldn't have been thought of that way a few years ago, is that I feel like a lot of the fighting inside the Democratic Party that is treated as ideological fights, a lot of it is really aesthetic. Yes. And part of it is Eric Adams talks, I mean, he talks like a weird person, but also like a normal person. Like, he's not in the sort of academic inflected language that you associate with the Elizabeth Warren campaign and things of that nature. And the interesting thing to me, when you map this onto the Democratic Party nationally, is that both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders got this in their own way in the 2020 campaign, that they had big ideological differences, but they both sort of were like candidates who talked like normal people for normal people. And it feels to me like the fight then that is being had inside the Democratic Party, I don't understand why there is an attachment to this aesthetic difference from the left, because it's clear that, you know, wherever it is on ideology, the left is on the wrong side of this aesthetic dispute about sort of what a politician should be like.
Except yes. For Bernie. So, yeah. So the left has significant aesthetics issues. I mean, so does the right. I would look at it this way. The alt-right, the sort of Trump guys who, you know, had their moment in the sun, but did alienate a significant portion of the right wing, albeit not as significant a portion of the right wing as is alienated by the left side of American politics by this tiny portion of the left. They do this too, and that is, they don't really want to be mainstream. They're not interested in being mainstream. For them, their brand is radicalism. It bothers them when they have to participate in normie-style politics. It disrupts their identity. And that's an issue, you know, something that we routinely deal with on the left is people who don't really want to succeed. They just kind of value the struggle, especially if it's carried out in sort of profoundly radical terms like that. So that's something that's sort of always percolating on the left, and it's something that's always being dealt with. And then one thing you have to counterbalance your desire for sounding badass with is the ask. So Joe Biden was really clever in that he didn't have a big ask. He didn't really want to do anything too terribly radical. He wanted very ordinary politics, and he said so in very ordinary terms. Turns out that's what the American people felt like after Trump. Bernie Sanders had a really big ask. He really wanted to change American politics, and he wanted people to be persuaded that it was a good idea. And so he put it in very normal, straightforward, ordinary terms. I think that's the right move. I think that Bernie getting as far as he did had quite a bit to do with that. Then you have people who have on the left a really big ask, and they decide to put it in the most alienating terms possible. And I really don't know what to do with people who think that's a great political strategy. It does not seem to be a good strategy to me. Also, I usually am not even on board with the ask with that side of the left. So, I mean, do I think they could learn from Adams? Yeah. I don't think of him as a highly conservative Democrat. If you look at his economics, he's for direct cash assistance to poor folks in New York. He's for subsidizing childcare for poor folks in New York on the municipal level. None of those are bad things. Those all look like really strong municipal programs to me as a leftist. So I do think there's a good note in there for onlookers from the left. Yeah.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Liz Brunig of The Atlantic and Ross Douthat of The New York Times to talk about the death penalty. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of Insider. On the right is Ross Douthat, columnist at the New York Times. On the left is Liz Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. According to the Gallup poll, 54% of Americans favor the death penalty for people convicted of murder, with 43% opposed. That's a clear majority, but back in 1995, Gallup found 80% in favor of the death penalty. One apparent effect of the two-decade-long trend of falling violent crime appears to have been a significant drop in support for the death penalty. This period has also seen increased attention drawn to cases where innocent people were wrongly sentenced to death or even executed. But Liz, in your view, maybe too much attention to those cases of innocence. You wrote a piece about this recently for The Atlantic. You're opposed to the death penalty in general. Why do people focus too much on innocent people who are sentenced to death?
Yeah, because innocent people who are sentenced to death are in a sort of nightmarish situation, especially if they didn't do anything at all, as opposed to having done something but not the actual murder, which also happens. And so that's the sort of rubber meeting the road on this system is imperfect, it's flawed, it's not going to be successful 100% of the time, which is something that death penalty abolitionists warn the public about repeatedly. And I think the hope with that kind of informational campaign about innocence was that eventually the public would realize this system is simply extremely flawed and therefore it doesn't make sense to leave it in place. And we should abolish the death penalty because otherwise we run a very high risk of putting innocent people to death, higher than we would accept in other domains. And the interesting thing about the public polling data that I cite in my article is that it seems that we have been successful in convincing people that there's a high risk of executing innocent people with the death penalty. I remember when Kay Bailey Hutchinson was running against Rick Perry for governor of Texas, there was a focus group Kay Bailey held in which the fact that Perry had executed an innocent man came up. And a Texas respondent said, well, it takes balls to execute an innocent man. So it's not that people don't know. It's that despite the fact that the vast majority of people are convinced this is a risk that we run, it actually hasn't eroded support for the death penalty writ large all that much. Even though it's something we hear about frequently, even Biden, who has expressed reservations about the death penalty, has mentioned the risk of executing innocents and so forth because it's such an enormous moral risk to take. Nevertheless, support remains high. And so to me, that was an indicator that, yes, this is a problem. But it's not doing the rhetorical work against capital punishment writ large that we had hoped. And I fear anything that runs the risk of appearing dishonest, I suppose. And I don't know if I was correct in this reading, but anytime I'm arguing with someone, especially conservatives, people who are politically different than me, I want to be maximally honest about my position and maximally honest about theirs, which means affirming the ways in which they're correct about their assessment. And so for the honest conservative who is in favor of the death penalty, who says, yes, but innocent people on death row are extremely rare, my intention was to say, yes, yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it. Most people, the vast majority of people on death row are guilty and guilty of very terrible things.
Why is it immoral to execute somebody who is guilty of a very serious crime? What's the moral distinction between that and other very serious penalties that the state might impose on people? I mean, we incarcerate people for very long periods, even for their lives. Why is it morally acceptable for the state to do that to people who have committed serious crimes, but not to execute them?
I have questions about America's penalties. We have much, much higher, longer prison terms. with less to show for it than other countries of comparable development that have shorter terms and less recidivism. So I think there's quite a bit of work to be done on our penal system. But the point is that when you're giving someone a penalty, barring life without parole, which doesn't exist in some parts of the world and didn't exist in some parts of this country until quite recently, barring that, when you're dealing with penalties, you're dealing with the possibility of redemption and someone resuming a life after a mistake, after a crime, after a sin, whatever you want to call it. I am a huge believer in redemption. I have to believe in it. It's probably the one thing that I believe in most. I think that the death penalty, more than other penalties, more than any other penalty, totally forecloses the possibility of a person being in any sense redeemed. Somebody can be redeemed morally. They can come to regret, even if they are in prison for life without parole. They can come to regret what they did. They can come to make amends. They can have a moral change, and that still matters in the lifetime of a person. That's still good. It's good to develop and grow and change. That's what we're all doing on the outside of prison, hopefully, is having those sort of moments of moral maturation. That's the point of all this. But if we are putting aside the death penalty and leaving open the possibility of someone maybe having a life after their crime, then I'm even more optimistic about the possibilities for change.
Russ, what do you make of that? That strikes me as more a difference of degree than a difference of kind, that, you know, the state acts very seriously, not just when it takes away a convicted person's life, but when it takes away that person's freedom. And I agree with Liz that we over-incarcerate in a lot of cases and that we over-punish in certain cases. But I think that for deterrence, punishments, and in some cases severe punishments, are a necessary and morally appropriate part of a criminal justice system. I don't see why, as a first principles matter, a death sentence couldn't be part of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the case for, given how capital punishment actually operates in this country, how few people we execute, how haphazard and winding the road to execution tends to be, I'm skeptical of deterrence-based arguments for capital punishment. I think the sort of remaining argument for capital punishment that keeps a lot of people pro-death penalty is simply an argument about justice, that in fact there are crimes that can be committed where it is, in effect, any penalty short of death is unjust, right? And that I think is sort of the moral intuition that makes people think, yes, you know, I can agree with Liz that, you know, we want there to be opportunities for reform and transformation, but for some people, be it a Timothy McVeigh or some other mass murderer, you want those opportunities for personal transformation to take place in the shadow of the punishment that is the only one that fits the crime. I think that is sort of what keeps support for the death penalty where it is right now. I think I admire Liz's honesty, while I'm not sure that she is correct as a matter of political practice. I think that, in fact, public opinion has shifted on the death penalty. Death penalty abolition has become more common in more liberal states, and executions have overall, with a brief late Trump era exception, become rarer, even in red states. I think the argument that you might be executing an innocent person has been a very effective argument there. But you do run up, as in other conversations about prison reform, against that reality that, you know, just as a lot of people who are in prison are there for very serious crimes, and you can't just, you know, eliminate America's prison population by de-incarcerating low-level drug offenders. In the same way, most of the people, yeah, who could be executed have committed a very, very serious crime. That is definitely true.
Liz, I think Ross raises an interesting parallel issue there that I think is similar in certain ways to this focus on innocence, when the vast majority of death penalty cases are not about innocent people. As we've had conversations about criminal justice reform and about reducing incarceration rates, there's this focus on nonviolent drug sentences. And you find examples of people who are in prison for a very long time for nonviolent drug sentences, but those cases are unusual. In general, people who are being incarcerated for a long time, committed serious violent crimes. And if you want to significantly reduce the incarceration rate, if you want to be more like the other countries that you're discussing there that rely on incarceration less, that's sort of a similar argument that you have to make, that people who have done very bad things, who we have good reason to be afraid of, should be incarcerated for less time, even if that entails some risk at the margin to society of more victimization by those people. That also feels like another one of those arguments that you need to make if you're trying to be honest. You also need to make if you're trying to actually achieve that policy change. But it's a much harder sell.
Right. I mean, any type of criminal justice reform is going to be a hard sell precisely for that reason, because it would be great if everyone who were screwed over by the criminal justice system were a completely innocent person or someone who just got caught smoking a joint and not bothering anyone. But as you point out, the reality is the majority of people in the criminal justice system, especially who have very long sentences, have very long sentences because they're guilty of crimes that are quite terrible and that we would, you know, in reading about them, be very frightened of being the victims of, and not without good reason. And so there's, you know, other complicating factors, which is that often crimes are intra-racial, which means, yes, the people who are in the criminal justice system are people of color. Oftentimes their victims are people of color, or their victims are women or other groups that we don't want to put at greater risk by simply opening the doors or something like that. And so, again, I think we get back to this sort of question of where left rhetoric starts to compromise left policy hopes or left ideals. And so my intention would always be to be completely honest about that situation. Yes, these are people who are guilty of serious crimes, and to try to form a policy that responds to that in a very serious way. And I think modeling our prisons on prisons in other countries that have better luck reducing recidivism than we do is one step. There's a prison in Pennsylvania that actually set itself up as an exact model of a Scandinavian prison. There's a documentary coming out about it called Little Scandinavia. They had good results. I know of lots of prison ministries. One of them is called Bridges to Life that focuses on reconciliation and sort of that moral maturation I discussed. They have great success reducing recidivism. And so I think there are a lot of possibilities here, but it's a lot less simple than saying, well, let's just stop and see what happens, right? And to be fair, I think oftentimes even that's a mischaracterization of the left view. But it does capture some left slogans that I think would be better left to, you know, sort of long and boring statements.
I think an interesting thing about the politics of these criminal justice reform disputes over the last few years is, you know, as we've had this spike in shootings since the start of the pandemic, there's been this expectation that there's going to be a shift in politics where reform falls out of fashion, the electorate becomes more reactionary, especially on crime issues, and starts looking for tough on crime policies again. And I think you need to sort of split that into arguments about policing and arguments about prosecution. And I think that clearly the left got out over its skis with defund the police last year, and there is not a broad appetite for a broad reduction in police presence in society. On the prosecution side, I think the left has made really serious political strides here, electing progressive district attorneys around the country, changing laws in states like New York in ways that that reduce pretrial detention and otherwise push toward a less carceral approach to criminal justice. And that looks to be more durable to me. You certainly see continued wins in district attorney elections by candidates who support positions like that. And so Liz, I'm wondering what you make of that split and whether that's a sign that some of these arguments that are tough sells are actually being made.
Yeah, I would take it as a sign. And I think that there's more going on with a lot of these arguments than meets the eye. You know, anytime you're dealing with activists that you see in public who are sort of marching or who are trying to raise awareness, you're going to be seeing a sort of intentionally sloganized and contained form of the goal because they're just trying to bring the public's attention to the project. And then theoretically, someone in that group has the actual policy proposal in its long format, which is, you know, sort of much more brass tacks and probably expands upon the slogan in ways that are useful. And so to the degree that that's happening, I think that's a good thing. I mean, that's something that I support. I'm a big fan of criminal justice reform. I think balancing that in the way that Eric Adams arguably does against, you know, these concerns about rising crime is going to be key for the midterms. So one of the sort of tendencies that I have seen among Democrats in the run-up to the midterms concerning the spike in homicides specifically is to kind of deny that it's happening. I think that's a really bad tendency because people are concerned about it. It's getting press. So there has to be some kind of rhetorical and political response there. Yeah.
Ross, I feel like there's this expectation from conservatives that the backlash on these issues is coming or that it's already here. And you see that both in the coverage of violent crime. You also see it in the organized retail crime in San Francisco and sort of apparently rampant shoplifting and that sort of thing. And obviously that's a problem. It's not clear to me that this is really the backlash political issue that conservatives are looking for it to be. Now, maybe it will be in the future, but it doesn't seem to me like the public has lost its patience on these issues yet.
I mean, I don't think we know, right? I mean, I think, you know, the Republican Party under Donald Trump became weird, let's say, in ways that the Republican Party of Richard Nixon in 1968 was not. And you had a pandemic. You had a lot of confounding variables. But even within that array, I think there's some decent evidence that anxiety in particular about everything from riots to the defund the police movement and how they intersected helped keep the Republican Party afloat in 2020 and prevented the kind of landslide that lots of the polls were showing for the Democrats. So with that in the background, I don't think you can assume that it's not going to be a winning issue in 2022. I think a lot depends, for reasons Liz was just sketching out and for reasons we were talking about with Adams, on the extent to which the Democrats can position themselves in a lot of races that aren't taking place in the deepest blue cities, but are taking place in suburbs and statewide in between their own activists and the Republicans, right? And if the Democrats can do that and you have some sort of settling of some of the spike in crime driven by things connected to COVID, like it's easier to commit crimes when everyone's wearing a mask, for instance, or you're more likely to have like carjackings when kids aren't in school, right? So if some of that goes away, then yeah, I think the politics of backlash get weaker. But I think it's too soon to say that, oh, it's not working just because a few progressive prosecutors in very liberal cities have survived. It's also just, if you have a policy of not prosecuting and incarcerating low-level offenders, any negative effects of that will presumably take a while to snowball, right? Because one of the reasons incarceration can be an effective anti-crime strategy is that it just takes people off the streets who are committing crimes. So if you're having more and more people on the streets who wouldn't be, over time, you would have a compounding effect. So a year or two of the policy is probably too limited a time to say what its effects on crime are overall.
Let's take a break. I've been talking with Liz Bruning of The Atlantic and Ross Douthat of The New York Times. We will be back to talk about the fight over critical race theory in schools. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow of Insider. On the right is Ross Douthat, columnist at The New York Times. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Legislatures in Republican-controlled states have been passing laws that aim to restrict so-called critical race theory in education, both at the K-12 level and in higher education. It's hard to even get people to agree about what they're arguing about in these arguments. And in many cases, the state laws are vague and broad, and educators have good reason to be unsure about what's actually allowed under them. But contrary to arguments from some Democrats that this controversy is entirely ginned up, there seem to be two very real areas of disagreement about curriculum and schooling. One is about the teaching of American history, disputes that are not really new, that are about how students should learn about the causes of the Civil War, the Jim Crow era, the advance of civil rights in the United States. The other is about the role of race and other identity categories in America today, how race determines privileges and outcomes, and how students should be encouraged to discuss and feel about their identities, including controversial efforts to encourage white students to think more about their whiteness. Ross, you wrote two columns on this. Can we start with the first? Because I think this is the easier question. Isn't it true that American history curricula have often undersold the moral errors in America's past, and in particular the way American ideals of equality were not shared with the whole population through a majority of this country's history?
Well, I mean, yeah, there was a narrative that was common to the teaching of U.S. history that, you know, sort of dates to, in some ways, the period after Reconstruction in the South, in some ways to the sort of consensus narratives of post-World War II American life that I think sort of acknowledged some kind of, you know, failures and falling short around race and racial equality, but basically told a story that either sort of wildly sentimentalized the, you know, racism, oppression, and racial apartheid of the South, even after the Civil War, or just simply didn't talk about that stuff at all. You know, if it wasn't sort of lost cause, gone with the wind sentimentality, it was just sort of ignoring the reality of the Black experience down through the Civil Rights era, right? And I think that had already shifted in many ways by the time we were in high school, but had shifted more obviously in blue states and liberal states than sort of especially Southern and conservative states. But there's sort of this ongoing movement away from a sort of, you know, post-Civil War, let's tell a story about, you know, sort of American history as white people fighting each other and then getting along again and sort of leave the subjugation of African Americans out of it to a different narrative that no one can quite agree on what that narrative should be.
Liz, an odd thing to me about these disputes, and you see, you know, the curricula and education schools around the country, I think, reflect the very left-wing composition of the sort of people who teach in those schools. And you see, you know, guidelines about, you know, how we're supposed to talk about cis-heteropatriarchy and that sort of thing in American history. And it just seems necessarily that if you have public schools, the curriculum that gets taught in those public schools is going to be, you know, somewhere in line with the ideological positioning of the populace whose children is being educated there. And it feels like that circle needs to be squared in some way. It's not that you should have a dishonest history curriculum, but I feel like there's been sort of an effort to end run the political process here that is necessarily going to assert itself in one way or another, that you can't just, you know, it can't just be a question for lefty history academics, how history is going to be taught in American schools.
Well, right. You know, we're a democracy. Education is local. So it's going to come down to the local level. And this has always been a conflict. It's nothing new. I think it's getting cast as a sort of wokeism coming to a final head. But remember, we've had these conflicts for over a century. We've fought about evolution. We've fought about sex. We've fought about every possible aspect of history and how these things should be represented in schools. So this is just more of the same. And I think we tend to fall out somewhere in between. And what seems notable to me is that there's an overstatement, I think, of the role that schools play specifically here in the development of what people think. So I grew up in North Texas. My parents are Republicans. They're very much like other people in Tarrant County where we grew up. My husband was in my high school with me. Human evolution was not taught as a fact in my high school. We had an abstinence-only sex education program, if you want to call it that, in my junior high. And I mean, I remember laughing about that at the time. There was no sense in which kids were hoodwinked. The kids who were inclined to think critically about that sort of thing already did. And the kids who were inclined for political reasons to take kindly to it already did. So I don't think there's as high of a probability of total brainwashing as being sold here. So the question should really be more about, you know, what is best in terms of fitting a curriculum that's going to give a sort of round understanding of history into a school year, et cetera, build them up for the next stage of learning about American history or civics, and less worrying about the capacities for indoctrination on either side, because I think they're less than they seem.
And then related to that, you get these periodic news stories with outrages that you see, some PowerPoint presentation or something where Tema Okun is this diversity trainer who has this whole list of things that are supposedly white supremacy culture and, ideas about timeliness and worship of the written word and things of that nature are somehow characterized not just as particularly white characteristics, but as pathological white characteristics. And this is stupid. But as Matt Iglesias was writing about this week, it's really unclear how pervasive this sort of thing is in two ways. First of all, we don't have good data on what school districts and what other organizations, because you also see this in employee trainings for adults, how widely this stuff is actually being used. And then also to Liz's point, to the extent it's being done, the extent to which people are taking it seriously versus rolling their eyes at it. And then this is the same thing on the other side. We don't have good information about, the archaic textbooks that still advance the ideas that Ross describes as having gone out of fashion decades ago, where you talk about the Civil War like it wasn't really about slavery or that sort of thing. We also don't have really good clarity on the extent to which that is prevalent in schools and the extent to which it's being taken seriously. And so it sort of feels like this argument is being had in an environment where it's not really clear how big the problems that we're discussing, how big they actually are. And Ross, I'm wondering, is that a problem with local control of education? It seems like not a great thing that we don't really have good insight into the extent to which children are being educated in certain ways and the extent to which they're actually taking on board the stuff that's being told to them.
Well, it would certainly be better for people in our profession if we had a national history curriculum, right, that we could all agree on how to fight about. That's definitely the case. But I think that, you can imagine also just how disastrous and polarizing in radically different ways that kind of debate would be. I think it is hard. You were sort of seeing through a glass darkly when it comes to figuring out how prevalent any given pedagogical style is. But you can also see things happening and changing, right? Like the prevalence of this kind of, educate students more deeply into their own whiteness thing, right? Like that is a spreading novelty of the last 5 or 10 years. We can't say how far it spread exactly or, how significant the transformation is. But, if you spend time in sort of, liberal-leaning private school areas, you can say that it's there and influential in a way that wasn't the case 10 or 20 years ago. Given how ideas that were seemingly confined to sort of esoteric parts of college campuses have spread to all of corporate America in the last 10 years, I don't think you can say it's crazy for state legislators in conservative states to look at things happening in elite private schools and say, we want to preempt that from happening in our own school districts. I think that's sort of an understandable way for cultural controversies to happen, even if you don't have a lot of data on the ground. I really enjoyed something the Times, my own newspaper, did a few years ago, where it sort of, literally did a side-by-side comparison of textbooks, history textbooks in California and Texas. So you could see how sort of a conservative tilt in textbooks showed up in Texas versus a liberal tilt in California. I thought that was an incredibly useful exercise. And in this debate, it would be great to have more things like that.
Liz, a kind of grim thing for me in this dispute is that simultaneously, there's been a decades-long dispute about how to teach young children to read. And you have phonics-based techniques that seem to be significantly more effective than other techniques that are used. And the stakes for this are fairly large in terms of reading competency for children who attend schools in the United States. And it doesn't draw the same level of attention because there isn't an obvious political skin to put on top of that for people to have a big ideological stake in that fight. It's remarkable to me because it feels to me like these issues, they get attention nationally based on sort of what's fun to argue about, rather than where the actual stakes seems to be in terms of producing good educational outcomes.
Well, right. So the arguments that we have about evolution, sex, or American history in schools, these are arguments that adults want to have with each other. And schools become a useful venue in which to have these arguments with other adults. The kids are sort of collateral. Pedagogy questions about reading are actually about the kids. And so you have a much smaller chunk of people who actually care. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, so I am keenly aware of the different pedagogical methods for reading, and I have very strong opinions on these matters. I'm against this whole language nonsense, which is, among other things, just not how English works. And so I taught my 5-year-old phonics at home. And that's the kind of frustrating thing that happens when you get someone with a weird, wild hair about how to teach reading to small children in a local school district. I wish that sort of thing received the type of national attention that whether high school kids are going to be told that that a focus on the written word is pathological white supremacy receives. Because whether my kid can actually sound out a word and figure out what she's seeing on the page seems to be much more critical to how she's going to function later in life than whether a kid gets out of class for a day by sitting through this dumb presentation.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Ross Douthat, what's your rant?
So this is really obscure in a way, but I was just reading a review of the new Apple TV musical theater quasi-parody Schmigadoon on Slate.com. And the review, you know, talked about how this, you know, this sort of loving send-up of musical theater conventions, quote, doesn't try to hide how contrived and problematic the mid-century artifacts of musical theater can be, meaning, you know, the big musicals of the Rodgers and Hammerstein era. And it references this, you know, this revival of Oklahoma from 2019, which supposedly exposed the seething underbelly of the original Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. I was not like a huge musical theater person as a child, but I've been watching the movies of these mid-century musicals and playing their soundtracks for our kids. And they're really weird and dark, like just as texts. Like if you ever sit and watch Carousel, for instance, like, you know, it's murder and mayhem and, you know, there's a deep and sort of evident darkness and complexity to mid-century musical theater that I think is totally underestimated by people who in our era think of them as like sort of sunny texts of, you know, romanticism and patriarchy that needs to be deconstructed. I think there's all this sort of pre-deconstruction, you could say, that exists in musical theater from 70 years ago. And in general, this is true of the past. People in the present always underestimate how subtle and complex and dark artifacts from 50 or 70 or 100 years ago already are without applying our contemporary lens. So that's what I have to say. Take the darkness of musical theater more seriously as something that already existed and isn't just there waiting to be discovered.
Liz Bruna gets her soapbox.
Today, USA Today broke an investigation that appears to show that the FBI was involved in coughing up information that led to the capture of Princess Latifa Maktoum as she tried to escape her authoritarian father, the ruler of Dubai, by yacht. She was captured, taken back to Dubai, where she's presumably being held captive, as had happened once before when she was 16. This woman badly wants to escape where she lives. She's not been able to do so. It's amazing to know that the FBI played a role. I realize that Comey isn't anybody's homie anymore and that it's no longer Mueller time. But I'm still sort of pissed off that we spent such a long time pretending the FBI is on the side of the angels, that they're our friends, they're going to help us. They're not. They don't. They never have.
for my rant, like I assume most of you, I've been watching in horror the images of the recovery from the collapse of the Champlain Towers South condominium in Surfside, Florida. It's just an unbelievable event that caused so much loss of life. And as I look at it, I don't know whether it has important policy implications, especially important national policy implications. And it's something that we're not going to know for quite some time. And it's an important thing to watch. We are going to learn, hopefully, why this building fell, how common the conditions that caused the building to fall are, whether there is significant risk elsewhere, and whether there are changes we should be making in the construction or examination or maintenance of buildings. And it's this one of these news stories where there's this time mismatch, where there's the focus now for obvious good reason, and there's a horrifying event now, but we don't know it's until sometime in the future when there may be less focus on the issue, what, if anything, we actually need to do about it. So I'm going to be trying to watch that myself as we have more information and as it becomes possible to develop a view on what, if anything, the government should be doing about this. I'll be watching that and I'll be seeing what I should be arguing for the government to do. But for now, there's nothing to do but watch in horror. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Liz Brunig and Ross Douthat. Left, Right, and Center was produced this week by Rebecca Mooney. We had help today from Nisha Venkat, and the show was recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.